Welcome to another episode of the WNS Practice and Business Management Podcast. It's not brain surgery. I'm your host today, Paul Camerata, and I'm honored to welcome as our guest, Dr. Jeremy Phelps. Dr. Jeremy Phelps is a neurosurgeon in Oklahoma City who completed his undergrad and medical school degrees at the University of Oklahoma, completed his neurosurgical residency at the University of New Mexico Hospitals. He has been a member of the WNS, CNS, and the Council of State Neurosurgical Societies for nearly 20 years. Dr. Phelps founded the New Mexico Neurosurgical Society and served as its first president. And he also reinvigorated the Oklahoma Neurosurgical Society and served as its president as well. He's currently serving in his eighth year on the executive committee of the CSNS and is the recording secretary. And he's also a current member of the WNS Practice Management Committee and regularly serves as a moderator, speaker, and course director for socioeconomic topics at national and state neurosurgical meetings. Dr. Phelps, welcome to the It's Not Brain Surgery podcast.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Always great to welcome a Sooner to Kansas, where I happen to be recording from. So Dr. Phelps, as I introduced him, is very familiar with some of the pre-authorization concepts and the landscape, the hassles that many neurosurgeons might now call this. Talk to us about the pre-authorization landscape, Jeremy, for those who are unfamiliar.
Sure. Pre-authorization or prior authorization is a means that health plans use to help control health costs. And that is done by requiring physicians and other healthcare providers to obtain prior approval or authorization from the health plan before specific services, or treatments are rendered. And, I think this was an idea that, you know, has some merit. If we step back and think about it, I think we always should be thoughtful about, you know, are we controlling costs? Are we doing the right thing for the patient? Are we, you know, following appropriate evidence-based guidelines? But as with many things, the law of unintended consequences sometimes catches us and takes us to some other places that we're really not wanting to be. And that's kind of where we are with prior authorization. You know, it's intended to help us find these kind of best practices. But what it's really turned into for many physicians and other practicing healthcare providers is a great deal of administrative burden. It has done a lot of damage as far as being able to get patients appropriate and timely treatments for certain conditions and illnesses. And it's put a lot of strain on physicians in their practices, whether they be private practitioners or, you know, systems as a whole. So it's a difficult thing that we all are having to deal with right now that has been seen by, I think it's touched every facet of medicine and neurosurgery.
Yeah. You know, when you're a resident, in your training, the cases just come in, you know, and you don't see any of what goes on in the background. And then when you become, you know, an attending, either at an academic or a private or hospital-based system, you realize some of these things that goes on, you know, behind the scenes, and how much of a burden that is. And it's, you know, it's true that you said this all started as a way to help, you know, control costs in our current system, but has become just a huge burden for some people. I have colleagues who are constantly, you know, saying, why is our pre-authorization getting so backed up? And can you talk to us about how that, what the mechanics of pre-authorization are? Is this a faxes between providers and payers, or is it phone calls, or is it documents?
It can really be any and all of the above. At this point, there are a number of different insurance plans that require basically forms to be filled out and faxed in, which are reviewed by basically a person on the other side of the table. Who then
not a neurosurgeon, probably, right? Yeah.
Probably not a neurosurgeon. More and more, many of these plans are going to electronic based prior authorization requests. As that process moves forward, it may then evolve into additional faxes or letters being sent, phone calls, conferences, those type of things.
Yeah, so it can hold cases up for, you know, for many weeks. I'm mostly have a cranial practice and is relatively unaffected compared to my spine colleagues. Maybe talk to us about that and why that would be.
Sure. I think that one of the differentials between the a primarily cranial-based, whether that be vascular or oncological, and the spine practice is that I think a lot of the cranial surgeries are a little more cut and dry. You have a tumor or you don't. And you know, certain things really aren't going to affect whether that aneurysm, you know, needs to be clipped or not. So we're not going to be dealing with things like, well, did we go through physical therapy? Did we give you 6 months of activity modification and those things? And I think spine has a great variability on how people treat certain conditions, how aggressive they are, how conservative they are. And that a large amount of wiggle room or variability, I should say, that large amount of variability does make it a little more ripe for things that may not need to be done that are done. I would think that that's probably a very small minority of the practicing neurosurgeons, hopefully. But nonetheless, I think that's the thing that's kind of low-hanging fruit that the insurance companies are trying to avoid, these big surgeries that cost a lot of money that may not be necessary.
Understood. Yeah. So just out of curiosity, I'm not familiar. Do other countries or other healthcare systems have similar processes? Let's say Canada, for instance.
I'm not going to claim to be an expert on Canadian medicine by any means. I don't want to misspeak. I think that other places do have, prior authorization type systems in place. I'm not super familiar with other country practices, to be honest with you.
Sure. So when a pre-authorization, doesn't go through, or when they require more information or often have you talk to somebody, talk to mm-hmm. us about how that goes.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that I, as I've given kind of talks and presentations on prior authorization in over the course of several years and in various meetings, one of the things that I look at, I use the analogy of my daughters who play soccer, and they're really good soccer players. And sometimes, they're both pretty young, and sometimes they'll make comments like, well, the referee caused us to lose the game, or we couldn't score because it was raining, or things like that. And I try to talk to them and teach them, that there are certain things you can't control. So you can't complain about certain things, but you have to control what you can control and make the best of it. And I think about that in relationship to prior authorization. We've got this big system. Nobody really likes it. But it's one of those things that we have to be adept at navigating. And I think from my standpoint, the way I look at certain things as far as pre-authorization goes is that one of the best things to do is say, what behaviors can I do or implement that give me the best opportunity to get things approved straightforward without having to jump through 10 steps? How can I make sure that those processes are implemented in my practice to avoid some of the headache and the hassle? And then, on that micro level, we can make those changes. There's the whole macro level of being able to change the system, which we can talk about in a few minutes, I think is a conversation that's very important as well. But one of the things that I've found with the prior authorization is that, I think, as I said before, I think most people are trying to do very appropriate evidence-based care for their patients, and they're trying to do the right thing. So many of the things that the prior authorization is wanting to have done are typically being done by the physicians. And it's not a matter of doing extra things, but a lot of times documenting that we do them and making sure right. that our documentation is well done and complete, and then making sure that that documentation is transmitted to the insurance companies in a way that they are easily able to understand what has been done and that all the appropriate criteria have been met. So that's one of the things that, I've really focused on in my practice. One of the things that I do is, you know, when I dictate my histories, for example, my clinic notes, it's done in a very regimented way. I talk about, you know, maybe pain first, and then the onset, the duration, the characteristics, what treatments have been tried, how long have they been tried. Mm-hmm. And I do that in a very direct way, in a very sequential way, in a consistent way, so that my office staff, when they are filling out these forms, they know where to look. If they want to know if the patient's gone through physical therapy, I know that comes right after this section. They can go right to it and find it. So I think that's an important thing that can be done. I mean, I have partners that they'll dictate part of the imaging studies in their history, and they mm-hmm. won't mention this, and it's all over the place. So it makes it really difficult to convey that information on some of these electronically generated notes that can be 8 or 10 pages yeah. to get to people. And I think that's a very important key for people to make that a very regimented thing of how you document what you've done and justifying the procedures that you feel are appropriate. And I think it's very important, you know, because in honesty, most neurosurgeons don't go through the prior authorization process themselves. They typically have staff do it. And mm-hmm. so yeah. the people in your office who are transmitting these requests or prior authorization requests, they don't have the training that you do. They don't understand things the way that a neurosurgeon does. They don't think like a neurosurgeon does. And that's all right, because they're not neurosurgeons. But it's important, I think, to sit down with them and go through, you know, when they ask about have they had this or this, it's really something that, well, this is where in my note I say that, and that's what it means. And so when they're asking you to check this box, that's what they're asking. And I think a little bit of training on the staff goes quite a long way.
Sure. So what do you tell neurosurgeons when you give your talks around the country who come up and say, you know what, this is just another thing that is thrown at me that, you know, makes my practice more onerous. There are people making decisions on the other end of the phone call who have, you know, not 1/10 the education I do. Why do I have to do this?
Sure. I think I would definitely say I agree to some degree that it is something that makes the practice onerous. I think the majority of us really want to just take care of people and do the right thing for our patients. And we'll consistently see on those surveys that come out with the American Medical Association, the AANS, CNS, the Washington Committee, some of the things that the physicians complain about. It delays patient care. It prevents my patients from having access to the care that they need. There is a great deal of a great feeling of a loss of autonomy, of being able to, you know, use the knowledge and experience that you've had to do the best thing for your patient. And we know that the number one driver of physician burnout is loss of autonomy. Mm-hmm. So I would agree absolutely that those things exist. I think one of the things that I would caution people on to some degree is saying, you know, it's just some guy with a high school diploma. He doesn't know anything. And that may be true, but more and more of these, you know, as one of the things that I've done in preparation for some of these talks is I've got on the phone with, whenever I have to do a prior authorization, I actually talk to the person. I say, okay, mm-hmm. help me out. Let me understand, you know, how we do this. How does your process work? What am I missing? And they've kind of really come back and said, look, most of this is automated at this point. The first two or three things or steps of this is typically done by a computer and an algorithm. It's not just some person back there arbitrarily stamping no on things. Yeah. So that's where I think going back to the very good documentation, you know, quality information in, quality information out is important. And I know some people get very, I guess, irritated or upset when they have to speak to another physician. I've never really had a problem with that. I think it's something from my standpoint that, you know, if you have good justification and you've done the right things, I think I can maybe count one time on my, you know, in a decade or more of practice that I've had a denial. Because if you're doing the right things, you know, people will typically, you know, understand, and you can communicate mm-hmm. your thoughts physician to physician. So I've never minded a phone call. And typically if somebody is a specialty that is not dedicated, for example, a spinal surgeon, they may be a pediatrician or a family practice physician. Mm-hmm. You know, if they don't see the necessity, a lot of times you're able to appeal that and say, I would like to have a person in the same specialty, be it spine or vascular or functional, that I would like to speak with about this. And that.
That's huge. Yeah. I didn't know that. You can appeal to someone
part
else.
Of the process in many plans.
Yeah.
Correct.
So Jeremy, how'd you get your expertise in this? How did you end up knowing all of this and then sharing it with us?
Sure. So one of the, you had mentioned in the introduction, I have been a member of the AANS-CNS for nearly 20 years. And I've been an active member of the Council of State Neurosurgical Societies for about 15 years. And the Council of State Neurosurgical Societies is basically the socioeconomic section, if you will, of the parent organizations. We are the group that helps provide a lot of the socioeconomic content for meetings that work very closely with the Washington Committee and the legislative efforts. So I've had that opportunity to be involved with those things for many years. I've been on the coding reimbursement committee. I've been on the practice management committee for several years. So, you know, these are issues that come up time and time again that are, you know, salient to all the things that we do. And as we go through time and things change, you know, we give presentations and teach courses on these. And then, of course, we do research and learn about all these things as we prepare for those courses. So I think it's just something we kind of pick up as we study and prepare and do these things for many years.
So in your time doing this, have you noticed that I've heard in the background that there are some senators and representatives trying to get some legislation passed that will make things easier for us. How is that
Absolutely.
Going?
And that is a very important thing. I think that speaks to the macro level of this, you know, where we kind of change the system. And I unfortunately see a lot of people, they shake their stick at things and, this is horrible. But, you know, they almost feel lost and unsure how to make some or affect some really important change. There is a huge push from physicians to streamline prior authorization, to make it better. That cuts across all specialties. And there is a very prominent bipartisan support for that. The Washington Committee, with Katie Orico as the director and Dr. John Ratliff as the chair of the Washington Committee, do fantastic work in, you know, trying to influence and help the elected officials understand the difficulties and the problems with prior authorization and the changes that need to be made. About a week ago, the Washington Committee sent out a report, basically with the most recent spending bill, prior authorization did not make it into the bill due to an elevated price tag, which is about, I think, $16 billion was the reported number, what they thought it would cost to do some of these changes. But the good news is that CMS has put forth some proposed rule changes just within the organization to help streamline prior authorization. And some of those proposed rule changes set to take effect would require insurers to do electronic prior authorization, which should help speed up some of the process, to implement timeframes within which prior authorizations need to be done. I think the window is 72 hours for urgent things and within a week for non-urgent things. Things like mandating that once a treatment is approved, that it is valid for the entire length of the treatment course. So perhaps, you know, if you get a surgery approved, say for a fusion, but the patient does really well with some injections and wants to continue that track, you have the flexibility to not have to redo that authorization down the road. So, you know, they're not gigantic steps and they're not the full overhaul, but hopefully some of those will come into effect and help some of the things that we are doing, you know, with prior authorization to make it easier on all of us.
Yeah, sounds like it. And it sounds like, you know, if any neurosurgeons have any contacts, that would be a good place to maybe get some traction.
Absolutely. I think I can't give enough credit to the Washington committee and how much efforts they put in and what a great job they do for all of us. And there are lots of things that we can do to help as individual neurosurgeons. Just the ability to say, I'm a neurosurgeon, perks up a lot of ears for elected officials.
Yeah.
And, you know, things that we could do. I would encourage all neurosurgeons to, you know, be aware of what the Washington committee is doing. They typically send out reports usually every few months about this is what our legislative agenda is. These are the things that we're doing. They have a fantastic website for advocacy at neurosurgery.org, I believe. And it lets you contact your specific congressperson or senator, and it has basically pre-made messages for different topics and why they're important. So you can literally contact your representative in about a minute and have a full letter written for them, which, you know, is very important. It's, I think that it's neurosurgery.org. Let me make sure I give you the correct neurosurgery.org. Very intuitive, very easy to do, lets you contact your elected officials. Other things that we can do as neurosurgeons, you know, donate to the political action committee that supports our efforts in this advocacy for, you know, medical liability reform, prior authorization reform, GME funding, research reform, all of these things. And I think one of the things that's presents a great opportunity for people is to be able to just see if you can get FaceTime with your elected officials. We often have meetings in the Washington, D.C. area. The CNS meeting next fall will be in Washington, D.C. It's a great time to set aside a little bit of time to, you know, get into the halls of the Capitol to be able to kind of see the inner workings there. They even have great resources on how to do it well on the Washington committee report. So, you know, I would definitely encourage every neurosurgeon to get involved and to reach out and support these advocacy efforts through the Washington committee and the AANS and CNS.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to close this this really enlightening discussion on unraveling the pre-authorization knot with Dr. Jeremy Phelps. Thank you so much, Jeremy. One last question, and I think I know the answers to this. This is, would this be Cowboys or Sooners?
Oh, sooner born and sooner bred. When I die, I'll be sooner dead.
No questions asked. Thank you so much, Jeremy Phelps. Really an honor to talk to you today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the It's Not Brain Surgery AANS Business and Practice Management Podcast. We've got some great episodes coming up. Stay tuned later this month. Doctors Lonser and Dunn will talk to us on contract negotiation tips. And we've got Dr. Richard Wones talking to us on ambulatory surgical centers overview later in February. So stay tuned. Thanks for joining us.